stories of my experiences with the Rav Zatzal, Rav Yosef Dov Soloveitchik Halevi. I'm telling them to Shavi, my grandson, for a number of reasons. One, because he's interested in some of the writings of the Rav, not having ever met him or seen him, of course. And also for posterity, for historical reasons, but I want to stress that these are my own personal experiences for which I can vouch, but not meant to be critical evaluations or of any kind of literary merit. There's no particular order which I'm saying this or which I tell the stories. Those have to be done at some other time of the proper editing, such as his views on life, his method of teaching, his political leadership, his community leadership, his personal attention to people for whom he cared, above all as a Rebbe. And so we will just go on kind of rambling, and sometimes maybe we'll have a chance to edit them. Just as the stories occurred to me, in our shul, the young Israel of Hugon's Hills, on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, we have two minyanim, sometimes three. But the major minyan is upstairs in shul. Then we have a very strong representation of people davening downstairs in the social hall, which doubles also for a place of davening. And Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, we usually daven Nusach Ashkenaz, not just the Mifteh, the accents, about the Minhagim. Now everybody knows Minhag Ashkenaz, for example, at Kiyas Shofar, during the repetition of Musaf by the Chazan, by the Baal Tefillin. In Nusach Svart, and also Nusach Ari, and most Chassidim, the Tkiya Shofar takes place during Tfilah B'Lachash in Musaf. And then again at Chazar Zushatz again. The total number of Tkiyas, of course, is the same. But we had a number of people who davened downstairs of somewhat more yeshivish background and Hasidic background, although they're all very modern Orthodox Jews, whatever the word modern may mean. And they asked me that to agree to a Nusach Svart Kiyas Shofar, meaning to have the Kiyas Shofar during the Tfilah B'Lachash. And I was well aware of the halacha of Losis Goydidu, meaning you're not allowed to create different kehillos in the same kehillah, different minhagim. And so I went to see the Rav on a day or two before Rosh Hashanah at the yeshiva, that's Yeshiva of Yitzhak Ochanan at Yeshiva University, to ask for his opinion or his psak. He explained to me why he thought that the Tfilah B'Lachash, Tkiyas B'Lachash, was more halachically acceptable, and that in his own shul in Boston, that's the way he does it. Matter of fact, he gave me a written psak, and there's quite a lengthy written psak, which was published in Hadaron, the halachic journal of the RCA. But basically, I'm not getting into the psak now, but what happened at the time. When he was finished talking to me, he looked at his watch, and he seemed to be very nervous. He was pacing up and down in his room, and kept looking at his watch, and I noticed that, and I said, Rabbi, why are you so nervous about the time? He said, I've got to get back to Boston. Somebody promised to take me to the airport at LaGuardia, and he hasn't shown up. So I said, it's not a problem, I'll be privileged and happy to take him. And he said to me, all right, I accept, but I have to make two stops on the way. I said, doesn't make any difference to me, I'll gladly take him. So he got in the car, and we drove just a, a block or so away from the yeshiva to 185th Street apartment house, they had to pay a visit for Bikur Cholim to Amichel Bernstein. Amichel Bernstein was a Ram Magid Shir. He specialized on Ramban. And he was a Talmud Muvak, a dedicated Talmud of Rav Moshe Soloveitchik. That's the Rav's father, Zechon of the Bracha. And they were very close. And so we come up to see him because he'd suffered a number of strokes. And he needed a lot of chizuk. So the Rav went upstairs with me. And we sat for about 15, 20 minutes, maybe half an hour, just talking about various inyanim. And the whole purpose was not just Bikur Cholim, but to give Rav Michel the feeling that he's still worth something. You know, the stroke that he had was very debilitating. And so they discussed on the Torah, some Minhagim, and the Rav sat there patiently and sort of gave him strength to see him through Rosh Hashanah. It was a tremendous act of chesed. And the Rav was about chesed to such a degree that people didn't even know it or believe it. Most of his chesed was on privately, not for public consumption. And I couldn't help but feel so impressed, almost awed, by the way he handled the situation. After a while, we got back into the car, and we drove to Grand Central Parkway on the way to LaGuardia. But on the way, he said to me, I told you I have to make two stops. Now the second stop. I said, fine, wherever you want to go. He said, I have to go to the cemetery, the Beit Almin, there's a cross, and Mount Judah, in Cypress Hills, which was up the Grand Central Parkway. It was sort of deviating from the main parkway for about 15, 20 minutes. And he told me he wants to go because he wants to visit the kever of his father, Rav Moshe Zatzal. Now, I had no idea that Rav Moshe was buried in that particular cemetery. But we drove to the cemetery. And the cemetery is on a street called Cypress Hills. And the cemetery is on both sides of the highway, of the road. And I pulled to the right and I said to him, which side of the cemetery do you have to go to? He said, on the right side. And you come to the entrance stop. I said, all right, stop. Because sometimes people drive right into the cemetery, almost up to the kever. He wanted to stop outside, which means the kever wasn't too far from the main entrance. He got out and I got out and said to me, please, stay in the car. I'm visiting my father's kever. I have to be by myself. As if to say, I've got things to say to my father before Rosh Hashanah. I have to visit his kever, and I'd like to be alone by myself. Obviously, I respected this. And I got back into the car, and he walked into the cemetery for about half an hour when he came back. And he was, I wouldn't say that he was disturbed, but he was preoccupied, probably thinking of many things about his father. I've never seen, I was so rarely seen, a kind of relationship between father and son as existed between him and his father, Rav Moshe. He used to tell many stories about his father and himself. For example, he said that when he left Khaslovich, that's the town where his father was the Rav, and he decided to go to the university in Berlin. Obviously, his father was not too happy. But his father saw him off to the train. His father and he had a very special relationship, a unique relationship, of mutual love and respect and affection. He said, my father never showed this affection to me. And I didn't show my affection for my father towards him, but we had deep, deep feelings. What bound us together was a love of Torah and the learning I did with him and he learned with me. So we're standing at the railroad station. He said, waiting for the train to come, not saying a word to each other. In those years when you left, you never knew when you'd come back. You never knew when you would come back home or see your parents again. In those years, in the 20s, Berlin was a continent away from Kaslovich in Lithuania. And who knows when he would see his father again. His father probably thought the same thing. He was standing at the railroad station, and finally the train pulled in. And his father didn't hug him, didn't kiss him, gave him his hand. He said to him, Bell, he called him Bell, Zay Matzliach. That's all he said. And he always talks about this. In every one of his drushes of Kibbutz Avraham, he mentioned that story. He said, my heart nearly burst with longing for my father. And I knew the same feelings were reciprocal. He had the same feelings toward me. But in our family, we don't show emotion too much. For whatever reason, maybe our intellectual interests, we try to control our emotions. But that parting was a terrible pain for me and for him. Then, of course, as the years go by, they both ended up in New York. The Rav became a Magid Shir Yitzchak Yochanan, YU, while his father was there. And I hear from people who went to meet him, of Moshe, that when the Rav came into the room, his father would stand up for Rabbi Yosheber, for the Rav. So this experience that I had with him at the cemetery was an amazing experience. And I could understand why he did not want me to be standing next to him, or any other living soul. He had to be, as we say, l'itachet im Abba Shelo, to be together with his father. Well, that was an amazing revelation to me, because he was the man, the ishalacha, the rational thinker, the great philosopher, the man who was realistic, this great man who dealt in great ideas, and was simply a son and a father. It so happened that after Rosh Hashanah, I went back to the cemetery on my own. I wanted to visit the cavern I found it. And I discovered at that time something very interesting, which I never knew. In the same section, there's also the cavern of the Almana, the widow of the Chafetz Chaim. I looked at the stone and said, I forget her name right now, Eshes, Morena, Rabbeinu, some kind of title about Chafetz Chaim. To me, there was a tremendous revelation that the Chafetz Chaim's widow was buried in Seth Cypress Hill, Mount Judah Cemetery in Queens, New York. And subsequently, I met one of her grandchildren, Rav Mendel Sachs, who was a Magid Shir in our yeshiva, the son-in-law of the Chafetz Chaim. And I asked his grandson, how was it possible that the Chafetz Chaim's widow was buried in New York? He said, because after the Chafetz Chaim was nifta, she was asked by her children in the early 30s to leave because they were afraid of what was happening in Europe. Some began to realize that things in Europe were not going to go well for the Jews. So she came to America, and she was nifta in America. This is how come she was buried here. I think she was his zivug sheni, his second wife. So he discovered all kinds of things on that cemetery, and the other gidolim were buried there. But that left such an impression upon me. So whenever I speak about Kibbutz Avraham, I think of the relationship. Some people are very effusive in demonstrating their love, kissing and hugging and embracing. Here there was none of this. But he had to be alone with his father. In Yiddish, there's an expression, had to speak to my father, discuss certain things with him. To me, it was a tremendous revelation of this man who's probably, I would call, the Rambam of our century. Totally without emotion, very often, how he emoted to be with his father. Of course, throughout the years that was my zuchut to know him, I saw him emotional many, many times. I remember one particular story when his wife Tanya was Nifta. So my friend Rabbi Holzer and I went to Boston to the Menachem Avil. And he sat on the floor, not on a chair, sat on the floor, totally distraught. And there was nobody in the house at that time except Rabbi Holzer and myself. But the Rabbi was very much involved in my own personal life on many occasions, as with many of his Talmidim to whom he was close. And I have to say, parenthetically, he was close to Talmidim who were close to him. There was a kind of an antenna he had. Which Talmud loved him, which Talmud was with him, not just with intellectual knowledge. You know, I'm sort of rambling, but one thought comes to my mind after another thought. I always wondered why it is that in Perek, they say, Pirkei Avot, Hamisho Talmidim Hoyelod Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai. Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai had five Talmidim. And I was wondered about this. Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai was the one who founded Yavne v'Chachomeo, who saved Yavne from the Romans as a condition to surrendering to the force and the power of the Roman Empire. Yerushalayim, which some people use in the administration for today's politics, sometimes you have to surrender. Totally inaccurate. Rav Yochanan was faced by the might of the Roman army, by the threat of imminent destruction of Yerushalayim. Today in Israel, we're not threatened by the might and the power of the Palestinian army. Isn't there any? So saying Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai taught us to give in, when you have to, we have to do the same. It's totally ridiculous, totally irrelevant. There's no dimion between one incident and the other. However, coming back to the Rav. So Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai had five talmidim. He had thousands of talmidim. Whatever we study today in Torah Shabbat Peh, especially in Shas, and Mishnah, and Gemara, is traced back to Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, with the foresight and the vision to know that Yerushalayim will be destroyed eventually. Nothing can stop it. At least save the spiritual treasure and the spiritual strength of Torah that we have that they cannot take from us. If the Jews were to survive, they had to have Torah. So he said to the Romans, "Tend the Yavne v'chachamecha." Yavne in the yeshiva. If I can save the yeshiva, I'll save Klal Yisrael. Of course, this is what happened. So he had hundreds, thousands of talmidim throughout the generations. Even his own time, he asked for Yavne v'chachamecha. The Chachma Yavne went three or four people. So what does the perek mean? Chamisha talmidim hayelo. The answer is, I'm convinced it's true, that the Rebbe may have hundreds of Talmidim. But they're not Talmidim. They come to listen to a shiur, they're impressed, they repeat the Divrei Torah. They think like the Rebbe thinks in solving a problem without establishing a personal relationship. Every Rebbe needs a few Talmidim, not many, that will do what he wants them to do without questioning. Hamisha Talmidim Hayolo. They were his. He could ask them to do this, to do the other, they would do it. And in my experience, being with the Rav together for 40 years almost, 3 years in yeshiva formally, the rest of the time maybe more importantly, in almost daily contact with him, I knew that the Rav could trust me. As a matter of fact, when the shul celebrated the anniversary of my being in the shul, his daughter, Tara, sent a letter to the dinner, which she sent a good wishes, and she said, "My father trusted him." And in a minute I will tell you why I think what he meant by trusted him. But he had five talmidim. Now five doesn't mean five, it could be 20, it could mean 100. But there's a Talmud, there's a Talmud. There's a kind of a Talmud who audits, he listens, comes to the shiur regularly, he studies Torah, but does not have a personal relationship. And because of Chasdei Hashem, I was one of those. A And I know most of them who were close to the Rav. There weren't too many. Some know that the Torah of the Rav, his Talmud, his learning, his philosophy, much better than I do. And I write Svarim, how the Rav explains Sufis and Shas and Rambam. I was not one of those Talmidim that understood every single word that the Rav was saying in the Pshat and the Rambam and the Tosfos and the Gemara. I was one of those who were ready to leave everything, metaphorically, to jump into the fire for him. And he asked this of us not too often. And I was able to guess, and so were my friends, to divine what is it that he wants, what is it that he would want. And I have to tell you, and I want Shabby to know this, that when I speak, when I think, hardly ever do I do this without thinking basically of four people who shaped my life. One was my father. My father shaped my life in many, many different ways. And this is not a question of a hesped for him, but my father was a man who was a man for all seasons. He was a Ger HaChassid. Although he didn't dress like a Ger HaChassid, that we leave to my son Ari in Switzerland. But he was full of Hasidus, of Ger, especially Svazanis, the Bess Yisrael, or the Ger HaRabein. He was a tremendous admirer of Samshel Feuer Hirsch, the philosopher Torah der Recherz. As a matter of fact, in 1937, he decided in Vienna that I was to go to Germany to study the yeshiva of the Samson Weifel Hirsch, Rafael Hirsch Gymnasium, high school, or yeshiva, where Rabbi Breuer in Washington Heights was then the Rosh Yeshiva. And he wanted me to go to the yeshiva. In 1937, the Nazis were already in power. So he made an application, and Yitzhak Breuer was the brother of the Rosh Yeshiva. Famous Yitzhak Breuer was president of Party of Gudel later on, who wrote a book on the constitution of the Torah and Eretz Yisrael. He's the author of this famous work, The Neue Kuzari, The New Kuzari. Great, great man. Wrote a letter of recommendation to his brother to accept into the school. And he wrote a note, I don't know if I still have it or not. I did have it one time. I say it first in German. It was two, three lines. Because I remember it, I'm a translator of English. Wenn der Sohn dem Vater nur im Geringsten gleicht, ist der Aufnahme wert. Ich meine, if a son, meaning me, is only in the very little like his father, is worthy of being accepted to the school. And the father looked forward to my going there, to be trained properly in Torah and Derech Eretz. Of course, I didn't go. It was 1937. And a year later, Hitler marched into Vienna. That changed the whole eponym of the whole world. So I did not go. But my father left me with his love for Hirsch, and I made my special function in life to study Hirsch. And I may not be the greatest expert in Hirsch, but I know a great deal about Hirsch, his Chumash, his writings. So he was the second person who influenced my life. The third person is the Svaz Emes. I find the Svaz Emes so profound, even if it's just one line. And many of the things that Svaz Emes says, you can find in Shamshon Rafael Hirsch's writings, more lengthy, obviously. And even in the Rav's drashas, his writings, there's a lot of ideology and the ideas of Svaz Emes. So these were the four men that shaped my life. My father, Shamshon Rafael Hirsch, Svaz Emes, and the Rav Soloveitchik, as we call him, the Rav. So he knew that he could trust me. As an illustration of what we meant by trust is the following. In New York, we have an association, an organization, which is now defunct, called the Synagogue Council of America. It was very controversial because it comprised synagogues and rabbis of every possible major denomination. And denomination is not a good word to use here, but group, shall we say. The Orthodox, the Conservative, and the Reform. And We worked together on certain inyanim, klapi chutz, the Rav laid down the guidelines. Do not discuss halacha with them. Do not discuss Torah with them. Don't even attend davening together with them if they have their own davening. But work klapi chutz. If you have to visit the President of the United States to plead for Soviet Jewry, if there's a problem that threatens American Jewish life, klapi chutz, to what the outside world, you should work with them. Because it's important for American Jews that one united front when it comes to the going. Not everybody agreed with him on this, but the rabbinical councils, the Adut Rabbanim, believed in this, and they followed strictly the guidelines of the Rav. Now, the Rav was not a particular great chassid of the Synagogue Council, but it simply agreed that it's an important organization. As long as he agreed, he remained in it. In fact, it came and fell apart a few years ago because they insisted on going beyond this. They insisted on discussing with the Christian community religious principles. And we have a veto power, like Abba Dale said. He could mix any proposal. And they were very upset by it, so it fell apart. But I remember 1965, the executive director of the Synagogue Council, Henry Siegman, who was a story with Me'atzma, was a Talmud Yeshiva Torah Vadas, but was a Shana Pirish. His father, Mendel Siegman, was a great mentor, a businessman, also very close to Rav Soloveitchik. Then he was the president of the Mizrahi in America. But this Henry Siegman asked me to become chairman of the Inter-Religious Affairs Committee of the Synagogue Council, which means to be in charge of arranging meetings and dialogues with the Christian community. And I didn't know whether I should accept it or not. I wasn't quite sure it was the right thing to do. And I represented the Rabbinical Council at the Synagogue Council. So I went to all the meetings, I made sure, and I went to every meeting. I wanted to be sure that they don't violate those guidelines that our observations are down for us. Anyway, I went to the Rav in 1965, I think it was, or 66. And I said, you know, I was asked to be the chairman of the Religious Affairs Committee. Should I accept? He said to me, no, you don't need it. What do you want it for? So I didn't. In 1967, after Mechemet Sheshet Yamim, the things changed. And Israel was the center of world attention. And we had to be very, very careful to look out for the interest of Medinat Yisrael. And the Christian community was very important to cultivate, to be on our side, not to be against us. And partially we succeeded, partially we failed. And again they came to me and said, well look, things have changed. Maybe you'll become chairman of the committee now. Of course, so Ezel Be'emlacher went to consult the Rav. The Rav listened for a minute and said to me, yes, you should do it. After he told me to become chairman, I asked him, Mikorim HaKosovama, 2 years ago or last year, I asked you, you said no. And now you say yes. He said, I'll tell you, 2 years ago, we were not in a crisis situation that we are today. And I knew if you take it over, you'll do everything what I want, and you'll ask me. I'll be busy all day answering your questions. Should I do this? Should I not do this? I know you already. That you would not move one inch without asking me. And I have no patience for this. I have no time for this. I have to study, I have to learn, prepare shiurim. So I said to myself, why should I send Shomfer for this? He's going to bother me all day with questions. There'll be other Orthodox rabbis who'll accept it. You mentioned two names, I don't want to mention them on tape. They don't bother to ask me. They're also talmidim of his in the shiur. They don't bother to ask me. They don't care what I think. So they'll become the chairman. Can't do too much harm. But now, in Mechemet Sheshet Yamim, Israel needs the help of every single Jew, and we need the help of the Christian community. At that time, there were a lot of chaylim who were prisoners of war in the Syrians and in Egypt. We had to work through the church to get them released, and we were successful. So now it's a different story. Now you have to do it. I don't want anybody else to do this. I know you do the right thing, and you can call me and ask me any time of the day or night. So I'm saying you thank your Hamisha Tamidim Hayyalay Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. He had five. It doesn't mean Dafke five. In Perkei Avot they enumerate the five. But every great Rosh Yeshiva, if he's great, and not all of them are great, develops a relationship with Tamidim where he can trust them. The Ikka is that the Rebbe has to be able to trust his Talmud, that he will not deviate, not violate what he teaches him, is Hashkafat HaChayim, and that's the important thing. So the Rav had a number of Tamidim, and more than five, obviously. I'm not going to say I was one of the five, but speaking from the point of view of a metaphor, a figure of speech, I was among those five. There were others, like Rabbi Meir Holzer, who was just as close to him as I was, and is to this day to his thinking. There's Rabbi Feivel Ries. There were two or three others, Rabbi Yisrael Klavan, the executive vice president of the RCA. We had a few, and they were close to the Rav. That doesn't mean to be close to the Rav. It means not to do anything which you think he would not like. So now the Rav is gone now 11 years. And I have to confess to this tape recorder, to Shabi, and Shabi to understand, whatever I do, decide to do in life, in religious life especially, in Jewish political life, I say to myself, what would the Rav say to me? And I believe that I know what he'll say to me. So I'm sticking to these guidelines, get myself into trouble sometimes because of it, and I stand in the front line of defending the Rav's philosophy. And so did the other seven of my colleagues who were the same kind of surrounding. And I could trust the Rav to give me the right advice. Sometimes he would give me advice which I didn't think maybe it was that important, but I did it. And then I found out how important it was. So this is Chamisha Tamidim Hayolai. So when his daughter, Atara Tversky, wrote a letter to our shul, sort of congratulating me for celebrating the 50th anniversary, the one line that is so important is, my father trusted him. There was another one who was close to the Rav, Rabbi, and I have to mention him as a good friend of mine, although he and I differed in other areas, Rabbi Walter Wurzberger, Rabbi Hashanah. He was a great philosopher, he was a great Talmud Chacham. He had very liberal ideas. He also had very, very conservative ideas. And he did engage in conversations with Christian philosophers. And we had a custom that the Erev that Chalamot Pesach, Rabbi Holzer and I, Santa took along our children, our boys, went to Boston to visit him. We spent 2 or 3 hours in Boston, driving up and flying up, discussing halachas and shalos and dinim and minhagim and philosophies and all kinds of counsel and advice that we needed. Wonderful experience. We sat with him for 2 or 3 hours and he relaxed and he was in a wonderful mood during those times. One of these visits, we also had Rabbi Walter Wurzberger, who was very close to the Rav too. But he was closer to the Rav philosophically than on a personal level. But he was very close to him personally too, because he used to be a rabbi in Boston. So we're talking about this problem of talking to Christians, philosophy, theology. Rav said, first of all, there's no such a thing as theology. We cannot have theology. Theology comes from the Greek word, it means the study of God. Who are we to study God? You have a slide in a laboratory, you look at the slide and you study it. You study your theory. It means this theory is something which you study and come to conclusions. Hashem cannot be studied. He studies us, but we can't study him. See, he did not like the word theology. And the Christians love the word theology. Or what is the Yesha HaNatzri compared to Moshe. And this thought strictly was opposed to, even at the risk of breaking up relationships. So remember this, Avraham Chalamot Pesach, we talk about this. And the Rav said, there's only one man and I say this to this tape, it needs to be said, whom I have no problem if he discusses religion with the Christians. He pointed at Rabbi Wurzberger, said, it is Walter Wurzberger. Him I can trust. As Walter Wurzberger was a great philosopher and a tremendous Bal Yerushalayim. Well, he was very modern. Look, he didn't have a beard. He walked around in a kippah. The people in the so-called yeshiva world had little regard for him. They didn't know how much of a Talmid Chacham he was, and a scholar, and a philosopher. The Baruch said to us, Walter Wurzberger, I trust. Not an organization, but as a personal, a person who can go to all these meetings, and Walter would go to Harvard University, to European universities. When we needed somebody to discuss with the Christians sensitive topics, Walter Wurzberger went. I'm saying this because they all knew whom to trust and not to trust. We had, in the summertime, we went to Boston for 12 years, every summer, for 2 or 3 days to be with the Rav and learn shiur. How did this come about? It came about in an interesting way. You see, I'm telling story within story, I'm just really just rambling. But one day we'll make sense of this. The Rav's Rebbetzin died, Tanya Simovich, and he was very alone and very sad, very broken up. I was saying to before, we went to see him and he was sitting shivering. And again, I'll digress for a minute. And he sat on the floor. He said something very strange to me. He knew of my own personal loss when Marty was Nifta. And I had a great deal of work to do within myself to accept the fact. I was left with 4 children. It was a very, very bad time. But Hashem helped me, as you know, and I'm married to Ima today, with her children. It was one of the great Chasdei Hashem. I must have done something right to deserve this. But in any case, the Rav turned to me and he said to me, he always would call me Rabbi Shantel. Very great belief in formality. You know, about liturgy yeshivas, they say, Du Rav Yankel, was sagst du, Mata Omer, Yankel, Moshe, Yitzig. The Rav was very formal. He believed in a great deal of dignity. And speech to him was a very important thing, how a person speaks and how a person writes. So he said to me, sitting on the floor, he was in a terrible mood. He said to me, it's very strange each time I think of it, and he turned to me and said, I need your help. I said, how can I help you? He said, you went through this yourself. You lost your wife, you left the children, and so he turned to me and said, tell me, I have a question to ask you. I couldn't believe my ears. He had asked me a question. Why is it that when Yonah Beilut, after losing a parent, is Yud Bet Chodesh, is 12 months? Why would you lose a wife? It's only 30 days, Shloshim. So I said to him that I thought about it myself. I think the answer is, parents are expected to die before their children. That's the way it normally is supposed to be. And Chazal extended Avelut for Yud Bes Chodesh with the Rabbanon, with the Reis, that's only 30 days, to appreciate what a person loses when he has. So Chazal wanted to impress us the mitzvah of Kibbud Av V'Em, because people are tempted to say, oh, my father died, my mother died. That's the way the world goes. You might get sort of accepted. And therefore they extended the Avilut for Yud Bet Chodesh, 12 months, to impress upon you that the father and mother died, can never be replaced. When you lose a wife or a husband, the pain is so great you don't need any, so to speak, artificial extension of Avilut. That remains with you forever and ever and ever. So therefore, it's only shloshim, because whether it's shloshim or 1 year, 5 years, that's something you will always remember. The Rav turned to me and he said, "You know, I'm glad to hear you say it." Years later, he spoke about this. When he spoke in Kiv Shurim in Moed Cotton, Bavelis, and he mentioned that. He didn't mention the time that I mentioned this to him, but this became something of his own credo that he believed. Just to show you how involved he was with Tamidim, when my wife was sick, she had leukemia, she said, go together for 5 weeks. And there was a great doctor in Boston, in Damashek. He was one of the greatest mumchim in this illness of leukemia, Rahmana Islam. But to get to him, you needed appointments of weeks and weeks ahead. So I called the Rav and told him what was happening. And I need an appointment with Dr. Damashek. Maybe he can help me get the appointment. He said, I know who he is, I never met him, but I'll see what I can do. Didn't take long, he called me back and said, I've made a few phone calls, and I have the phone number of Dr. Damashek, and the nurse who makes the appointments, you speak to her. So I called the doctor in his office, this Dr. Damashek, and the nurse said, well, Dr. Damashek doesn't have to see the patient. He has to see the slides. Send us the slides. We did, because there wasn't too much you could do about it. But the Rav was so pained that one of his talmidim has this problem, that he himself got into the trouble to make phone calls and discover where this Dr. Damashek has his office, and called me right back just to help me. And he was good in many, many ways to his real talmidim. Those who like Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, Chamishot Talmidim, are your Lord, they were his. And a good Talmud will do what the Rebbe wants to do. And all the arguments I have today with some people is, what would the Rav say today? He said, the Rav is gone already 10 years, listen, times have changed. I've never accepted it, I never will accept this. Because these are Torahs Nitzchiyot, Torahs Netzach. And Netzach doesn't change. Rav Boruch Be'er Kamenetz, he was the main Talmud of Rav Chaim, the Rav's grandfather, Rav Zeide, said, whatever Torah I say, I heard from my Rav Chaim. Now, never say anything that he wouldn't have said, that he would have disapproved of. I remember saying, Shimon the Gemara says about Rav Elezer, Shalom Adava Shal Hashama Mipi Rabbi. So Baruch Be'er said, how can it be? He never said anything his Rebbe didn't say. What it meant was, he never said anything that his Rebbe would not have approved of. And that was the greatness of Reb Chaim. Reb Chaim
said,
yeah. So Reb Chaim had the same thing. The same applies to the Rav and his Talmidim. Rav Chaim had many, many Talmidim, but none like Rav Boruch Be'er, Rav Kamenetz. He lived and breathed Rebbe, and this is what the Rav meant to me, and to the handful of people who, to this day, speak his Torah, teach his Torah. We have meetings, questions in Kashrut, and questions in politics. We always say, what would the Rav have said? How would he have said? And this is how we remember him. And I stay in touch constantly with his children, especially with his daughter, Atara Tversky, who tragically lost her own husband, Yitzchak Tversky. The Rav lived with Yitzchak and Atara Tversky in Boston for many years after his wife died. They showed tremendous kibbut avraham. I've never seen it like it before. Yitzchak Tversky learned with the Rav. He was the son of the Talmud Rebbe. He had a PhD from Harvard. A great, great scholar, a great Talmud Chacham. He became a Hasidic Rebbe after his father died. But he comes as the Talmud Rebbe, but he was a professor at Harvard. He was a great, great man. and he died after a short illness. And so I speak about Kibbutz Alfa Em as far as the Rav is concerned. He lived with Atara, so I speak to Atara after a call, make sure to call her for Purim, which is her mother's yahrzeit, and Pesach, which is Chalmai, which is the Rav's yahrzeit. I'll call her during the year at least once a month or so, just to keep in touch with her. And then we have a problem, and I say to Atara, you know, people saying this and the other thing, I speak about certain personalities who are doing things which I think are wrong, or claim, well, Rabbi Soloveitchik agreed with me. And she confirms my view, it's a lie, it's not true, he had no little use for some of these people. But everybody speaks about the Rav, the Rav, the Rav, the Rav. His books, his writings, they're great. But it may sound funny for me to say, I know what he thought. Sometimes he spoke things that people will point to me, see, it's not like you say. It may be, but I know in his innermost heart, in the plim, in his plimiyut, how he thought, what he believed. I can honestly say that I know him to this day, ki yidati, the man shit savas bono. It's interesting, the Sosemis points out, what does yidati mean? When Hashem said to Avraham Avinu, before he destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah, ki yidati leman shit savas bono. So Rashi says, ki yidati loshon chiba. Sosemis uses this very often. To know somebody means to love somebody. When you love somebody, you know somebody. That's what Rashi says, ki yidatev. Rashi is the greatest of Rashi. Rashi said, losh l'chiba. In fact, the Rav would say to us, if Rabbanim want to do good things for their balabatim, for the people that kill him, they should teach, besides Gemara, Rashi, Rambam, Rishonim, Mechonim, most Rishonim. As a great achronim. In fact, he was said about his great, about his grandfather, Reb Chaim. He always used to say, I'll say it in Yiddish first. The Remes is a zedek v'in a rishon. I've gelebt mit zeit vom achronim. He said, the truth, my zedek was a rishon, a rishonim. Except to live in the time of the achronim. But the Rav would say to us, we teach all the things you have to teach. Teach Chumash and Rashi and Ramban. And Ramban used to tell us, don't teach Bereshis with Ramban, the Parsha Bereshis. Start with Lech Lecha. Because in Bereshis and Noach, they're very different with Ramban, and really have to understand philosophy, you have to understand what the Ramban meant to say, and that many people understand the Ramban. But the Parsha Lech Lecha, begin with Lech Lecha, you find the Ramban, the rest of Chumash. It lights up the whole shot in Chumash. It's a teach Rashi Ramban. It's better than all the Musa Svarim, all the Sifte Musa, they teach about Hashkafa and Hashkafa Dachayim, Rashi and Ramban. So, I'm mentioning it to you because the Sfasemis points out, Ki Yidatev, Losh Lechiba. So when I say, I knew the Rav, I can say it honestly, the Losh Lechiba. Hardly a day passes I don't think of my father and my mother. Hardly. On some occasion, whenever something comes up, and the Rav, every day. And our Chagas Smicha, we got Smicha, the Rav spoke, and he said two things. Again, which are sort of a guideline for me. He said, first of all, remember, those were the days in 1951 when the conservative movement in the form was very, very strong. And the Orthodox rabbi in the smaller community especially played a very minor role. Oh, the Orthodox sort of dismissed him. He said, remember that the conservative and reformed rabbis cannot hold a candle to you. They are not Tamid Chachamim, Tamir Shamayim. You have the whole power in your hands and in your thinking. You are entitled to feel superior to them. Don't show it by calling their names. See, the Rav never believed in pejoratives and insulting people, never did. He had a great deal of disdain for the conservative rabbis, but he never showed it in public in terms of name calling. He respected them, civil to them. That was his personality. But in Halacha, his famous psak that everybody knows, somebody asked him, he lives in a town, there's a conservative temple, no Orthodox shul, and the only place is called Rosh Hashanah, the Yad Kiyah Shofar. The Rav issued a famous psak. It is better not to hear Yad Kiyah Shofar, which is Mitzvah Lasei Midaraisa, not to hear it, than to hear it in the conservative temple, which is a makam that is against Halacha from beginning to end. For him, this was a very, very strange psak. To most people, to me, it was not a strange psak. That was his essence. It's like the type of the sheretz of the other. But he had very clear to the personal respect for all these conservative reform rabbis. He met with them, he talked to them. They came to him in Boston to visit him. Very, very civil to them. But in essence, that's what he was. Not many people know this. And I've seen him on these various occasions. So the Rabbis have won a great deal in Kibbutz Avraham. Again, as you see, sort of rambling, of nothing prepared, it's just as it comes to my mind. He said in Parshas Kedoshim, it says, Ish ima v'bavit tiroi, v'shafshas ha'tishmaru. So if everyone knows the Rashi, of course, because they also mechuyiv in Shmira Shabbos, you don't have to listen to parents when they give you orders to violate the halacha. Kibbutz Avraham stops at the place where they want you to violate halacha. But the Gemara itself says, Jesus say, Abba lo kach kosta batara, you don't say the father Jew is wrong. The Chumash says different. You have to do cheretz for parents. So he said, but what is the real reason why the Torah has this juxtaposition of Shabbos and Kibbutz Avraham? He says, Shabbos is the one day which makes sense to a lot of people. You have to rest one day a week, you know? There's the famous Medrash said that, but I don't often say it, but we all know that my own, support for this, that how Moshe Rabbeinu taught the Jews Shabbos, there was Shama Shabbos in Mitzrayim. How can there be Shama Shabbos in Mitzrayim? Moshe went to Pharaoh. He said, listen, you got these slaves, they work for you, they're tired, they'll die on you if you don't give them a rest. Let them rest. So Pharaoh said, yeah, it's a good idea. A horse also has to rest. A horse can work 25 hours a day, 7 days a week. Okay, you got it. When you want this rest, this is on a Friday, he said, tomorrow. So Pharaoh said, okay, tomorrow. So that is a day that people understand. You have to have a day of rest. It's a present day. I once heard a reform rabbi, again, I don't mention his name, although it came from an Orthodox home. He said, how do I spend Shabbos? Shabbos is a day of rest. I take off my shoes. I put on my slippers. I turn on the radio or the phonograph, and I listen to classical music. I take my pipe and sit back my armchair and I smoke my pipe. What a wonderful thing. In the afternoon, I take my car with my wife, go for a ride. That's how we spend Shabbos, obviously. Everybody spends Shabbos, everybody interprets it differently. Everybody understands, it's logical. But what about when Shabbos comes along and says, thank you very much. I want much more of you. I want Shmira Shabbos. You don't go to work on Shabbos. You don't turn the light on Shabbos. All the mitzvahs lo say that. You have a business meeting, you can't go because it's Shabbos. You can make a lot of money in the stock market calling the broker. No, Shabbos is no. The Shabbos comes along and makes demands on you. Demands something. not just sitting back in an armchair and reading. That they don't, that they want. The Shabbos has two aspects. The logical aspect, you have to have a day of rest. Everybody understands this. But we understand Shabbos differently. Chiddush HaOlam, the whole Sheshi Mebereshis. The Rav said, Shabbos makes a lot of demands. People give up jobs, people give up businesses, these opportunities. That's what Shabbos is. Shabbos is pleasant, and the time is not pleasant, and that is when the test is if you shama Shabbos or not. He said, keep it up, very much for mitzvah. So you come and visit your father in a nursing home, make sure he's got everything he wants. You're visiting at home, you found your mother. And you say, hey, Pop, how you doing, Pop? Okay, Mom, you need anything? About, you want me to go and buy you something? Yeah. The parents say, no, I don't need anything. You know, it's okay, it's all right. People understand, keep it out for him. But after there was a story, there was a man in Boston, a very rich man, who didn't go, his father was in a nursing home, in a Bet Avot, and didn't go to visit him too often. And so the father complained to the Rav. The Rav called the son, and the son came, you know, as the rich was to talk to him. Says, speaks to him about Kibbutz Avraham. He says to him, Rabbi Soloveitchik, how can you say that I don't do the mitzvah? Go to the nursing home. There are three big glass windows, beautiful windows. I donated them in honor of my parents. So comes Father's Day, I always go visit the father, bring him a box of candy. How can you say that? But Kibbutz Avraham is a very beautiful mitzvah. Go with your father to a ball game. And if you're in a shiva, you go to your father to a shiva. Faith lesson. But there comes a time when Kibbutz Avraham is difficult. Parents get old. They can't walk. You have to give them a cane to hold. And you have to see that they're well, take them to the doctor. And sometimes they talk gibberish when they get older. And sometimes you have to bathe them, you have to wash them yourself. It's not easy. This is why the Torah has Shabbos and Kibbutz Avraham together. Ish imam roviv terol. Under what conditions? Under all conditions, the same way. Et shabsasa tishmer. Shabbos is nice, but Shabbos comes along and says, you're shomer Shabbos? You can't go there. You can't do this in Shabbos. It's hard. Kibbutz Avraham? Yeah, you call your father, you call him on the telephone once a month. Fine, great. But at times you have to do much more. That's difficult. And this is why the Torah has these two together. And the Rav would always speak of Kibbutz Avraham. Always, always. To tell stories about his parents. That his father, Rav Moshe, was lived in Gimel Shvat. In Gimel Shvat, he had the Yotzat Rosh. And he gave 4 hours shiurim. They were divided usually in 2 hours of halacha and 2 hours of agada, of hashkafa. And people came from all over the world to listen to him. If you wanted to hear, he used to give those shiurim at the yeshiva, the big hall called the Lampert Hall. Usually started at 8 o'clock in the evening and went till at least 12 o'clock, sometimes longer than that. And after 2 hours he would say, no, you had enough or you want more? And he said, no, and then you have to play the crowd. That's one thing he did know. And so 4 hours shiurim, people were riveted to their seats. And you had a lot of conservative rabbis that came to listen to him. And all of his droshes were recovered his father. I remember once he said, the pasuk had hit him, Yerochach Hashem Nirali. I see Hashem from the distance. So sometimes you come, you see something in front of your nose. You don't see, you don't notice it at once. But then the further you got away, the more you're away, the more you realize how important it is. You have to take a few steps back. And he used to say to us, even in the shiurim, so you go to a museum to see paintings, the old time, don't stand too close to the painting. Step back a few steps. Then you get the feeling of a painting. All the same applies to Havel, to shiurim, to Torah. He said, when you see it in front of your Rashi, it says, take a few steps, stop thinking. And then the pshat will come to you. He said, each year, and at the Yosef of my father, Gimel Shvat, I love him more and more and more. And I understand him more and more and more. And I understand how little I understood him when he was alive. Rochak Hashem, you're in the air, from the distance. And he said, this is why Bilam and Balak, the Pasha, Bilam said to Balak, let me go to the top of the mountain. And Misham, from there, I will do what you want me to do. You're too close, you don't see. You have to be away a big distance. And the truth is, and I say this to Shabi, and through Shabi I'm saying it to all our grandchildren and great grandchildren, that the thing is to remember. And the more time passes, the more you have to remember. Yesterday in Shul, today is Yischa Chag Pesach. Yesterday in Shul, they're doing Yischa and the Shabbos, you know, Yischa services, down Yischa. And I quoted the Rav, and I quote him all the time on this. There's a Pasuk which we say in Musaf, Shimon, Nesra, Rosh Hashanah, in the Ibrach and Zichonos, Aben Yaakov Yefraim, Yevet Shashuim, Zemide Dabrebo, Zohar Eskar Anahu. The Rav said, the sequence is wrong. As I speak to him, I remember him. You should say, on the contrary, I remember him, that's why I speak of him. No. You don't remember because you remember. You have to speak of him daily, every day. And this is how you remember. Midei Dabrebo, I speak of Ephraim, which means Chal Yisrael. Therefore, Zohar Eskerenel. Because you don't just remember. You get busy with other things. You remember, you forget. Shikha is one of the things that people are guilty of. But if you make it your business every day to repeat the Vatar, your father, your grandfather, your Rebbe, Rashi, Tosfos, they're all our fathers. If you speak of it, you remember. You can't be a God-fearing person, a pious person, unless you study Torah. You study Torah, Hashem. It's a daily mitzvah. Then you remember Hashem. So he said, Zohar, and Midei Dabrebo, because I speak of Ephraim, Zohar Eskerenel. And this is why when we get together, my friends and I, we have a problem, what would the Rav have said? How would the Rav handle it? Remember the Rav, the Shia said that. This is how you remember it, how to remember. So why is it that Moshe Rabbeinu is called Moshe Rabbeinu? Because he taught us, and we're learning his Torah every day, so you remember Moshe Rabbeinu. So this is basically how I live my life according to the law. And I must say something else. I mentioned before that there are four people that have a major influence in my life. That's my father and my mother on many occasions, so of course, and my parents. Avsham Shafal Hirsch, that's from Amos and the law. And I must say quite openly, not a day passes that I don't think of them. And I look at my own life, whatever it may be, I don't know, but it is fashioned by the principles of these four people in my life. Everybody has to have somebody who's a mashpia. Now Mabavich, they call it the mashpia, not the Rosh Hashiva Yizmusa. The mashpia. Who's the mashpia in Mabavich? They have a sort of mashpia ruchani. They call the mashpia. It is hashpa'a, the most important part of life. And you have to be willing to accept it. If you don't need to accept it, what point is it? And so I can go on and on with many stories of the world. One particular story which I think will tell the way it is, the Rav had a Rebbe as his father, Rav Moshe. His grandfather, he remembers, it was not as if it was still up high. But other than that, he really had no rabbis. It's the only rabbi that he had, that his rabbi, that he considered his rabbi, besides his father, was in the town of Haslovich, where his father was the Rav. They were all Lubavitch Chassidim. So how come they had a misnaged that his father to be the Rav in town? There's a long, long story. He once told us what to do with the war of Napoleon, the Russian spies. It's a long, interesting story. Anyway, he said that his first Rebbe was the Lubavitch, the old-time Lubavitch Chabad people. Not today, everybody's Lubavitch. Those are real solid people, Bala Machshava, Bala Raya, Bala Rayonis. And his first Rebbe was the Lubavitcher. And he would teach him Gemara and whatever, but he would teach him Tanya at the same time. And his father, Moshe, was happy about this. So when he was sitting learning with his Rebbe, he could hear his father come, quick, quick, the father's coming, put away the Tanya. That's how he won. So he was a great chassid of the Bala Tanya. He would quote the Bala Tanya. He would quote the writings of the Tzemach Tzedek, not that much, but the Bala Tanya, the Likud the Torah, the Likud the Tshuva. He gave rushes on sales of a Tshuva in big hotels. We rented them. And I always mentioned, if you want to know what Yiras HaShamayim means, study the Tanya. So it's all the time. Now he had a rabbi in his later life, in his other life, as a student in Berlin, Rav Chaim Heller. I don't know, Shavi, if you heard of him. Rav Chaim, after some of his sorrow, Rav Chaim Heller was a short man, tremendous Rav. And he was a great gadol b'Torah. There was nothing that he didn't know. But his shiur always based on Tanakh. I went to one of the shiurim. Was given the Carnegie Hall in New York once a year. Some rich people paid for this. He would come with a little Tanakh in his hand, that's all he had, and discuss and explain. It was a remarkable, remarkable shiur. And the Rav was one of his Talmidim in Berlin. The Rav was in Berlin at the university. In those days there were a group of very remarkable young people studying, like, for example, the Lubavitcher Rebbe himself, and the Rav, and one or two other people. And he studied the philosophy of Helmut Cohen. Helmut Cohen was a German-Jewish philosopher, but a very unique way of teaching. So the Rav would consider Chaim Heller his rabbi. In fact, if Chaim Heller was Nifter, the Rav delivered the Hesped. And he wrote them an article, the Hesped was written up, Shmuel Maklap, you see? Yes, I saw Shmuel Akkad. Chaim Heller was a small man. I remember in the summertime it would be in Long Beach, near the beach. And I was driving in Long Beach, I forget to visit somebody, I think my friends were staying there. And I saw Chaim Heller going on the main street with a shopping bag. He stopped at the grocery. Up at some Yerakot, and he bought whatever he bought, he still carried it. So I went over to him, stopped the car, I saw him, and I went to him and said, "My fellow, excuse me, let me carry it for you." He said to me, "Why? It's not heavy." I said, "It's not heavy. To me, I'm Chaim Heller, you go grocery shopping, you'll carry some potatoes." I said to him, No. And he really couldn't understand why I would want to help him. "No, I'm a man, I can carry out a shopping bag." God is of Chaim, is a Chaim Heller. Tremendous anivus. He didn't think there was anything special what he did. But he was very close to the Rav. Now I have a picture, a historic picture, someplace in my picture gallery. And after the Avenue of Shini, where Yitzhak Chon Yeshiva, the Yeshiva University, on the corner, Rav Chaim Heller, the Rav, and Rav Belki was president of Shiva University, the previous study. I would give anything in the world if I knew what they were talking about. I'm sure they were talking about Kofi Annan, the United Nations. And tremendous picture. I can't locate it. I know I have it someplace. The three Gidolim, each one in different ways, different way. I have some of Heinz Heller's writing added to the section. And how did I get an interesting story? I needed a bookcase. It's on tape, but it's an interesting story. I needed a bookcase for my books. And this goes back many, many, many years. If you want to get a good bookcase, second-hand used, you went to Harlem. In fact, you had lots of old stores that dealt with old furniture. So I come into a place, they see a book, a small bookcase, and say, I want to buy it. It was a goy. Probably it was a white goy, you should shop for it. The goy, oh, this bookcase, maybe it's $15, $20. He says, you Jewish? I said, yes. You in Hebrew? I said, yes. I got a bunch of Hebrew books here. I'm going to throw them away, but who would use them? If you want them, you can have them. I found there the following. Abramsky's Chazon Yecheskel, Yadid Tosefta. I found the Yalkut Me'am Lois, an original edition. I'll show you later on how they have enough stuff there. Originally in written in Ladino, on old paper, and I found Rav Chaim Hellersworth.
The
Tanakh?
What?
The famous Tanakh? No, the edition of the Pesikta. Some Targumim. I found it there, gave it to me. I said, how much pay? How much? I'm happy you take them off my hands. So what am I going to do with them? Shows you what it means. It's called Yikar HaMetziyot, how you find them, you know, not without, what you would say, searching for them. It can't be made, you know. So I've given you a little bit of some of the stories, hundreds of stories. You know, as I talk and I remember them, the Rav of the Kew Gantz Hills once, he had one of his Talmidim who was really close to him, Dr. Alan Goldstein. He's a doctor here and he's in Float. He was all sure. He knows the Rav sure well. And he was sort of his personal doctor too. And he came to Kew Gantz Hills to see him. It was late, so he stayed overnight. Next morning, Dr. Goldstein calls me, he said, the Rav just got up, he wants to say, what time you daven Yeshua? I said, 7:30. Okay, the Rav is coming. But he didn't have a twin with him, right? Give me your twin. So I came to Shul and I gave him my twin with him. He took my twin. And he sat down, you know, and sit on the bench. And I didn't sit next to him. The next day, I removed a few benches behind him. And people should say, Rabbi, why don't you sit? Listen, love some aging, he's a rabbi, right? But me, he can sit next to him. I couldn't figure this out. No, Baba, I couldn't figure this out. So I'll never forget that morning. That's what the Rav had might know, well, might know. And then after he finished up, he came back to me. He said, you know, when I put the film together, they gave me the twin to put together. And they didn't. He said, I'm not asking you to do this because I want you to do it. Everybody has his own way of putting back the tzuras. On one side, on both sides. So I don't want to change the way you have the tzuras. Another story of the Rav, I'll tell you an interesting story, a humorous story, interesting story. There's a rabbi who lives today in Ramat Eshkol, Isaacs. He was rabbi in New England, in New Hampshire, or Vermont, or a number of places. And there's still a little yeshiva left there. Not probably, 10 bucks of the name of the town. Bangor, in Bangor, Maine. So he had a son in Kew Gantz Hills, Yossi Isaacs, very nice young man, he moved out. And he came to visit for a Shabbos. So I welcomed him. We walked together. And he was also Talmud of the Rav. But the Talmud was there for a couple of years, but you know, he was afraid of him, so kept a distance. But tell me an interesting story. He came to yeshiva, and he went to a bechira, and they put him in the shiur of Rav Soloveitchik, in his shiur. What? After 2 or 3 days, he wanted to quit. Because he couldn't arrive in those years, my years. He was very sharp, very sarcastic. To the Talmidim, if they didn't understand what he was trying to say, he had no patience. How come you don't understand? Well, I just explained it to him, right? And he would say to people, you're saying it because you have no brains. You're saying it because you're not paying attention. He would throw people out of the shiur left and right. People did love it in the later years. No patience. They said, well, say the Tosfos. know, if the person kasha the tema, the moral bavitzia says this. So I'll say, what's the same bavitzia? No, didn't look it up. You come to Mashiach, out. Don't come back for the next week. You have to be really prepared. You expect you to prepare the Rishon, the Ramban, the Rashba. It's very tough, very tough. And some people, the Mamish couldn't take it. In fact, we had four Tamilim in the Shia when I was there. One was called Scheinfeld, one was called Schulman, one was called Schoenfeld, and one was called Schoenberg. So the Rav would come in and say, say the Shia, say the Shia. But the Rav was excited about the idea that he had, Chiddush or something, he stammered. You know, say, you would say, say the Shia. I would try to hide. Oh, please, don't let it be Schoenfeld. Don't let it be Schoenberg. They pick on you and you better knew. So this Isaacs couldn't take it. Mamish couldn't take it. Exactly. He went to Mr. Abrams, who's the registrar of the Yeshiva. He said, I want to leave the Yeshiva. I just can't take it. My nerves can't take it. Oh, you can't leave. You can't leave the Yeshiva because you want you to get permission to leave the Yeshiva. Oh, the next morning, he's there. And the Rav had a sense of humor, he was in a good mood. He said, Isaacs, I hear you want to quit my shiur? You're afraid of me? He said, tell me what you do, sit right in front of me. And don't worry, I'm not a cannibal, I won't eat you. And that changed his whole life. So the Rav said, sure, I can have. He said, you're afraid of me? Sit, so now sit right in front of me. I'm not a cannibal, I won't eat you. And one day we had in the Shia, there was a rabbi, he lived in Queens, smart boy, brilliant guy, but never learned. He was able to plot his way for the Shia. I went to a Shia at the Shiva to Tutu Rabbe, the Rav and Rav David Lishis. You ever heard of Rav Lishis? So, Rav Lishis learned with us Cholin and Yeran, Cholin. Just with Yehudah, most of them. He would come to the Shia with 20 swans, one on top of the other, and look this one up, on Kibbe Eger, and on Milchas Chinuch, and there's the other one. And he spoke very slowly. And this fellow, I don't know his name because it's not fair to him, he would say, you come, just say the Shia, say the Gemara. You stop lapping the Morris Chalala don't exist. And they say, Rabbi, yeah, but the Shasol Chuvas the Tashbats. Tashbats quotes the there's never. It's not like you say. I don't even know the Tashbats. Yeah, it's okay. Well, look it up. And then they would say, no, but the Rav Kiva Egan, Simulam and Heike quotes this and the other. Lahayo and Ivan. Your blood is way through, like, I mean, that's where you go through. Now, the mission was a great time to talk about the Mega. I didn't see this last month. We went to the Shia of the Rav at the same time. They worked this way. Monday and Wednesday, he went to Rav David Lishitz. And Tuesday and Thursday, he went to the Rav Shia. So this fellow, take a little, pulled the same thing with the Rav. And he'd get up and say, Rabbi, what do you do? You know, there's the Maramin says this. Where's the Muhammad? There's a Muhammad. He's not a Muhammad. Not like this. After a couple of minutes, they're off Quran, what he was doing. He said, oh, wait, so she drove him out of his broomstick. You get out of here. For him, this is a circus, this is entertainment, but you're a magician or something? Out of my shit. They threw him out. So this man had a mother, a very nice lady, very poor, for embassy. And she knew the Rav. She knew him personally. She called him up, please, my son is desperate, you know, what do you do to him? What do you do to him? What do you do to me? After 2 weeks, he doesn't come back. This guy was a very funny guy. There's a bus stop in front of the yeshiva. And the bus only stopped when you wanted the bus to stop. So the bus comes, the bus travels, yeah? Puts his foot on the step of the bus and ties his shoes, shoelaces, I don't know. Thank you very much, let the bus go on. This kind of stuff you pull. he was once going out with a girl for a shidduch. He never met her before. So she said to him, "Well, how would I know you?" They met, they agreed to meet at Penn Station. You know, where is it going to be? "I'm wearing a black hat, and this and the other. And how would I know you?" She said, "I have a blue jacket, a blue blouse." So he would come in and look and found her. He wouldn't meet her. She was too ugly for him. He took off his hat and walked around and never met her again. He took German in school. And the professor, Rosenstein was his name, was deaf, had a hearing aid. Right? And he asked the students to read the passages in German. Again, this fellow was not prepared for it. He brought his way through all our college. And he said, "Oh, you say this, read this poem." He didn't know it, so like this. So he said, "Oh, he's deaf with a hearing aid." Then he started to this guy was a Russian. Brilliant boy, mind like a blotting paper. But then he went this way, he came to the rock from the food. He said, "Where's my woman? How long is the Russian?" Once he said, "Pshat in the first door of the Pshat in the first." And somebody, one of the sins come in, stepped out of the first place, quite a lot, getting that. That says not so. It was a very spanish, you fight the kasha, because it's contradict. Also, there's no such questions.
It's the same story with the time.
Huh?
It's the same story with the time.
I couldn't be like this, because the person wouldn't say what you're saying.
Yeah.
But that's what happened in my share. No such questions. But he said, no such questions. You're misreading the whole business. It's wrong. No such thing. So, but he loved, didn't mind if he contradicted him. But you see, he was so for truth and learning. I remember once in this year, came across a one that I'm 11 mikvahs, and he couldn't make out the Rambam. Couldn't understand. It bothered him. And all these years he learned his Rambam, but now suddenly realized that this can't be. He would go out, get up from the chair, but two things would happen. Go to the window, look out. Stand. "Why do you do with this Rambam? What do you do with the Rambam? You could see him paint. Mommy's paint for this." He said, "All right, let's sit down and see what we can do by tomorrow." So I came at the shop. I want to remember this year, two things I remember that he did. He got stuck in the Rambam, and he was desperate. He couldn't figure it out. This year lasted usually two and a half hours. Not about an hour or so. He said, "No, can't be. Close to tomorrow, walk out. Come back tomorrow." But tomorrow I had it worked out. And the other time I remember, the rooms were, I had about 40, 50, 20 living in the shiur. And there was no table. Someone took out the table. So they said, "Rabbi, we'll bring you next door, there's another table." "All right." Bring in the table. And he said, "You know, we used to sit like this. See the picture I have there on the wall there? I sit like this and bring it
out." In your office.
Yeah, no, in the office, yes. "No, I have one here too. But this one," so it says, and all of a sudden he takes the hand out and looks around. He says, I didn't know. So he goes up. He said, "Neither Hanshikivos. What happened was the table they brought in was used the other room as a shofar for Kriyas HaTorah. The brought in the other room. It happened to be the table that the other room used for davening as a shofar for Kriya. And Allah is not allowed to lean on the shofar for Kriya. A table that's used exclusively for Kriya's power, not allowed to lean. See, but really could see for some set. See that this? I didn't know. It's the shofar for Kriya next door. He might recognize the table, maybe it was slanted, whatever news. It was upset, you people think it's great for long, upset about the table. He couldn't carry on with the shit. He said, "You know what to do, how could this happen to me?" So we switched tables to another table, but the rest of the shit was, see, it was, mama, she was almost trembling. Okay, Shabby, you have to leave now, and I'm... Are you taking this tape with you? I'll tell you, I want to review it.